Okay, continuing some thoughts on personal evangelism. One of the things we talked about was how God has always emphasized personal responsibility. It's personal accountability is something that we see. We went to Matthew 25 and looked at that. Each man there in Matthew 25, 14 and 15 held responsible for what he was able to do. Which means I'm not held responsible for what you're able to do, and vice versa. I have opportunities, I have abilities, you have opportunities and abilities, and God expects us to meet those as they come. Now, this responsibility of personal evangelism, again, what is evangelism?
Teaching.
Yeah, teaching the gospel, teaching God's word. Some ways we looked at that we fulfill this responsibility, we do it by teaching publicly and privately. Both of those need to be met. We do it by supporting others who teach. We certainly do that here with Brian Faulkner and Murphy Priestley. And maybe, I don't want to say any of these is more important than the others, but this may be the one that gives us the most opportunity and is the most effective, and that is preaching through the lives that we live. We looked at 2 Corinthians 3, 2 and 3 about how basically our lives are an open book to everybody around us. You know, you can spend all day teaching the gospel. You can know this Bible cover to cover, and if you don't do this part, what a waste. What a waste. Because what do you appear to be to everybody around you? If you know scriptures, but you don't live it.
Hypocrite.
You're the biggest hypocrite in the world, and how effective is your teaching going to be? It's just not going to happen. And you see, and Jesus even warns about that. What does he say time and time again to the scribes and the Pharisees? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Did they have knowledge? They did. You can't deny that. I mean, these guys, some of them very, very great students. Unfortunately, they were as good as students of the old rabbi's teachings as they were of actual God's word. But they had the knowledge. They were just hypocritical in their application of it. So Jesus calls them out on it. That's something we need to make sure we're not doing is conflicting what we teach with what we live. Good.
Our lives give credibility to what we teach in most cases.
It does. It does. And in somebody's life, you actually see the effect that the gospel's had upon them. You see the changes that they've made and the way that they approach things, which is not to say that we're not going to stumble and make mistakes. That is going to happen. But Christians should recover well, and they should help each other to recover. And you should see something different, should see that light. We talked about it in Matthew. Let's actually go there. Look at it one more time. Matthew 5. I think pretty much everybody knows this section of the Sermon on the Mount. Someone will start in verse 13 and read through 16 for us. Matthew 5, 13 through 16.
You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Those people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven.
We know that, right? Every one of us knows what this section says. We know what it means. The idea there, and just the illustration he gives are fantastic. Salt is good. What if salt loses its flavor? What is it good for? Nothing. And if Christians lose their flavor, to use that idea, if they lose their light, what are they good for in this world? We're good for nothing. We need to see that and let it sink in. We should be shining that light. We should be the example that God expects us to be there. Good. Any thoughts on anything we've talked about so far? Turn to John 1. Let's look at some examples. What's going to make me do this? I know it's important. I'm not blind. I can read. I can see that Jesus wants it done. What's going to make me actually do it?
Love it, man.
Okay, love for God, absolutely. That's a huge part of it. If I truly do honor Him and respect Him and want to make Him happy, I'll do what He's told me to do. Good. What else?
Love for other souls.
Love for the souls, especially the souls of the lost. Right? If I want to see others saved, this will be a prime thing that I'm chasing after. Look in John 1, verse 40. Here's Andrew. One of the two who heard John speak, this is verse 40, followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which is translated the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. Now when Jesus looked at him, he said, "You were Simon the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated a stone. And just let that moment sink in. Who found him first? I mean, when we talk about Peter, you always think of Peter. He's been right there with Jesus from the very beginning. But who found him first?
Brother Andrew.
Andrew did. And what did Andrew do?
I
got to tell my brother. We have found the Messiah. Do I act like that? Because if I'm a Christian, have I found the Messiah? Yes, I have. I have come to know Him and I have been baptized into Him. I have a special relationship with Him. Should I want to tell somebody about it? What about the people closest to me? Should I want to tell those that I love and I know that they need to know? Andrew did. And then you go and you just think, what did this lead to? Just this simple conversation. What did Peter's life become? He was introduced to the Messiah. And then Peter went on his own. I mean, certainly we know he stumbled, but Peter, he loved Jesus. He loved Him to the day they put Him to death. And yet, someone introduced him. Who introduced you to the Lord? I just think some of us here were fortunate enough to grow up in a family, and we were introduced early. I mean, we probably had songs sung to us before we could even have a clue what those songs meant. Some of us did, and we were introduced later. But somebody cared enough about me to tell me about Jesus and the cross. Do I care enough about others to do the same thing for them? This is an important question for us. Same chapter, actually, next verse. Look at Philip. Verse 43, the following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Now Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." So what does Philip do? Same thing, right? He goes and he tells Nathanael. And Nathanael's kind of funny. And I remember we were going through this first question. He asked it, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" You know, he's not exactly on board when he first hears this. Of course, Jesus is going to convince him. Jesus is going to convince him he's exactly who they say that he is. Remember, down in verse 48 or so, Jesus has talked to him like he knows him. And Nathanael says, "How do you know me?" He says, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." And he knows. He knew everything. He saw him then. And then, of course, his mind changes quickly. True, you are. You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. So he comes to know him as well. But Philip introduces him. Go to 1 Corinthians 9. I just want to see something that Paul does here. 1 Corinthians 9, we'll start in verse 19. We'll look at some things that Paul is teaching about the importance of this idea. We can make some applications, but I want to talk about what he did and what he didn't do. Because I think people can take this way out of context and go somewhere that we don't have any right to go. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. Paul's writing to the Corinthians, and he says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be a partaker of it with you." So Paul was everything to everybody. And let's consider what that means here. He went to everyone with the intention of doing what?
Saved.
Yeah, for them to be saved. Teaching them the gospel. Now, did he take the same approach with everybody?
No. He came from different places.
Okay. Now, did he teach the same gospel to everybody? Yes. But what I mean by approach is, to the Jews, he became as a Jew. And let's just consider this. If Paul were meeting with some people or having some people over to his house to study, do you think he gave everybody pulled pork sandwiches for lunch when he was studying with the Jews? No, of course not. That would have violated their conscience and that would have shut that down immediately. He became as a Jew. Did Paul know that it was okay under the law of Christ for him to eat pork? He wanted to eat pork?
Yes.
He did. Did those Jews know that? No, and there's no way he would do anything to offend their conscience. He became as what to them?
As a brother.
He became as a brother in Judaism to them in the sense, not that he followed the law of Moses anymore, but he knew what violated their conscience and he was aware of that. He didn't step all over it. When he came to the Gentiles. Now, to say he became a Gentile unto them as they were, he didn't worship Zeus with them. But what are some things that he might have done? And I think we see this in his teaching. We actually can see it in the book of Acts. Whenever he goes in first to a synagogue, when he and Barnabas are traveling, you notice what he talks about a lot of times? When he's talking to the Jews, he starts with Abraham a lot of times. He speaks of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He talks about the promises. Now, why might he do that to the Jews? They know those promises, right? That's what they've been brought up on. You go and watch when he is dealing with a group that's primarily Gentile, what he normally, the kind of stuff that he talks about is basically, look around you. Look around you at the creation. Look around at the rain that God has provided. Who provided this? The Creator did. He doesn't say a whole lot about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why not? Because these Romans don't have a clue who those people are. So what does he do? Whomever he's around, he molds the message to fit them, but he doesn't change the truth of the message. He never takes away who Christ is and the necessity of obeying Christ and being in him. But his approach is based on who he's dealing with. Now, is that a lesson for you and me? If you are studying with somebody who doesn't even believe in God at all, Should you start in Revelation? You know, should you sit down and start going through some of these difficult prophecies? It might be a better idea to just start in Genesis. And let's talk about who this God is who created everything. Let's talk about what sin is. Because if somebody doesn't even believe in God, chances are they don't really know what sin is. Let's talk about what it is. How it's a violation of God's will. That's all sin is, right? Sin is breaking God's law. What better place to see that illustrated than at the beginning in Genesis? I may need to start there with someone like that. Now, what if you have somebody who is extremely religious? They know a lot about the Bible. But they practice false doctrine. Maybe the book of Acts is a good place to start with them. Let's go look at the Lord's church and let's see what they did and what they practiced. How did they become Christians? Maybe that's a better place to start with them. Do we see that? See, we still do the same thing today if we're wise. We need to. What did Philip do when he taught Christ to the Ethiopian eunuch? Where did he start? He started in Isaiah. Why did he start in Isaiah? Because that's where he was reading. See, this is just wise. We need to be wise in our approach as well. Good.
So, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I think this is also teaching us about how it's appropriate for us to develop relationships with all types of people.
Yeah.
And you do that by finding a common place, you know, with them. And it may not begin necessarily with spiritual things every time. And I think that's part of what he's teaching here, like to the weaker. You know, he lists all the different categories. Is he developed those interpersonal relationships with those people by having something in common so you could have a conversation, so you could develop trust, so you could talk to them. Because innately, when you get into the spiritual realm, it's going to be a conflict.
Yeah.
Because they're somewhere else and Paul's here. So that's conflict. And if you begin with that, we all know the people then were just as we are today, you're going to go separate directions on those meetings.
Yeah.
So finding a common bond, developing relationships such that you can have a trustful conversation about spiritual things where you are separated is necessary, it it's helpful. Paul teaches us that as Christians, we need to be about that. We need to be all things to all men. And each of us in here have a lot of different relationships and a lot of different walks of life where we can do that.
Yeah.
So we need to think about that. It's not just, we don't need to just leverage only spiritual things. Use the physical things you have in common with someone else to develop a relationship. Now, most of you know I kind of like to play golf. And every time someone asks me, what did, in fact, I had it again yesterday. They asked me, well, do you play in the club championships and tournaments and that sort of stuff? Some years ago, I developed, there's an opportunity. I said, can't do that because I'm not going to go play golf to miss worship service on Sunday morning. That's not appropriate. Now, I said, if they'll adjust the times of the tournament things, I'll see, you know, what I can do. And not yet found a good, you know, most golfers are good. I try to bait them a little bit into that conversation, but it's an opportunity for me to talk a little bit about golf with somebody that's asking a question, and we, the church, and going to worship services and that sort of stuff in there. It's kind of that, developing that interpersonal thing that is around golf and something I do, you know, with other people.
Yeah. Andy said something. He mentioned a bond of trust. If somebody just comes up cold and they want to talk about spiritual things, if you're not very, very spiritually inclined, what is the typical first response if somebody just comes up and says that? I remember when I didn't know much about God's Word and somebody came up and just out of the blue and said, would you like to talk about Jesus? I mean, just like in the Walmart parking lot. My response was usually, I don't have time right now, and I'm creeped out, you know, because it's dark and things like that. But what if you trust somebody, and you know, I mean, you've developed a relationship with them. Is that a more effective conversation to have? I think a lot of times it is. And I'm not saying we shouldn't go up and mention things like that, but let me give this example, and then I'll catch your comment, John. If I went up to my neighbor the first time I met him and said, you know, I saw where you guys practice baptism by sprinkling. You know that's wrong, right? And that doesn't count. What further opportunities am I likely to have with him? But what if over the course of time, when I see him outside, I help him move stuff around and I cut his grass for him and we just go out, I just talk to him. What about over time? And then I invite him to a Bible study about baptism after that bond has been built. Do you think you might have a better chance of some of that sinking in? I think so. And you know, this is one of those things that requires long-suffering and patience. And some of us aren't very good at it. We expect, we'll just throw it and it'll immediately happen. This takes time to cultivate it. It did for me. And if I'm honest, when I think back, I didn't obey the gospel the first 5 seconds I heard it. It took time, and it took some good examples, because the first time I was taught the gospel was by a bad example. What they were saying was true. What they were doing was not. And so what did I do? I just kept on. I just said, I'm fine. I'm fine where I am. So it has to be both. And certainly Andy's point about building those relationships, that will make it much, much easier for us to have these deep conversations with somebody. Go ahead, John.
If you drop down to 24, it says, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but the one that receives the prize, run in such a way that you may obtain it? When he's going through all these things, he's talking about the way he's approaching them.
Yeah.
But what stands out so much with Paul is his zeal and his passion to do it.
Yeah.
He made opportunities and chances to get people drawn in, but they also saw how much fire he had in himself.
Yeah.
And that can draw people in too. They see you're excited about it. I want to be like this guy. There's a reason he feels this way.
Yeah. One of the preachers that I had a chance to be around last October when we were studying together, he said he does a morning walk every morning, and he'll catch people out. They'll be, you know, just trimming the hedges or whatever. He is the most gregarious guy. I mean, he is just bubbling with life. And somebody was up on a ladder cleaning, or he had these huge hedges. He was cutting them. And Ken walked by and said, oh, no, the guy said to him, said, good morning. And Ken said, oh, that was his first mistake. He never should have said anything to me. Because Ken immediately follows with, it is a beautiful morning. It is a beautiful morning that the Lord has made. And I'm glad I get to share in it. And then he just started talking to him. Now, in that way, you can kind of ease in and talk about things. But I want to be more like that. You know, not the abrasive type. But I want to look for opportunities and see them better. I'm afraid I miss so many just because of, well, I don't want to bother this guy, or I'm just feeling kind of shy. You know, just because this is me blaming myself. If a guy in Walmart had a visor with an Auburn symbol on it, I believe I could talk to him. I believe I could immediately find things to talk to him about. Why can't I use the fact that he has a soul that's in danger as to look for something, anything to start that? It should be important enough to me. Good. This relationship is so very important here. And again, going back to both Andrew and Philip, who did they go to? When they found truth, who did Andrew go to? His brother. Philip goes to Nathaniel, the people that they are close to. They take it to him. And kind of going back to Andy's point, these are people they already had relationships with. People who would have trusted them. You think Peter and Andrew would have had a trust between them? Very likely so. So makes a good person to go to there. Good. Steve?
Peter and Andrew also teaches us that you don't know where that one soul will lead to.
You know, I think of some of the people that I know who are gospel preachers now, and it makes me laugh so much when I think back to when I first met them. I'm just like, how in the world did you get here? Well, I know how. This is how they got here. But how far have they come? And I'm sure they said the same thing. But you can't, and that is proof that you can't look at somebody and judge their heart. And you can't look at somebody and judge their spiritual potential. That goes back to that parable of the sower. Sling it. Good soil? What will happen when the seed hits good soil? It'll take root. It'll grow like crazy. I don't have any right to judge that. I just need to do and to try to plant the seed. With that in mind, sometimes, and Matthew's talked about this before, sometimes we may not do all of the planting. Sometimes we might do the watering. We might build on somebody else's work who's come along. They may have heard truth 10 years before, and then we might come along and water it. Is that okay? Yeah, who cares? Who cares who gets the credit? If somebody obeys the gospel, that's what we're going for. That's what we're trying to build toward. Now, here's some thoughts on ways we can be successful. You guys have kind of already touched on some of this. Turn to James 5. James 5, if someone will read verses 19 and 20 for us, please.
My brother, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his ways will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins.
Okay. In order to be successful, I need to realize what a blessing it is to teach the lost. Because according to those verses that Mike just read for us, what can the teaching of the lost lead to?
Covering
them
for sins.
Yeah, sins being covered. Sins being cleansed and washed away. Is that a big deal?
No.
Yeah, and when I see that's what can happen through teaching, it should be a motivation for me to want to do it. If you could save somebody's physical life, would you do it? Would you do it? I mean, you're standing on a boat, somebody falls over, there's a life preserver right next to you, would you throw it to them? I think everybody in here would say, yeah, of course. Of course, I would do whatever I could to help them. Spiritually speaking, you see somebody drowning in sin, you have a life preserver, you have the gospel, the truth. Will you throw it to them? Nobody would hesitate in the physical, would you? Nobody. You would take that thing and throw it, and you'd be yelling and hollering, saying, come get him. And maybe some of you who are strong swimmers would just jump on over the side. You go in after him. Spiritually, do we do that? Are we that apt? Are we that convicted to do it? I pray sometimes not so much. We say, well, I sure would like to help him, but I really don't have a whole lot of time right now. And I know he believes some of this stuff. It's going to be an awkward conversation. I guess I'll just let him drown. I mean, we would never come out and say that. But is that what we might do sometimes? I'm afraid it is. Do we see how important teaching the gospel to others is? And then just from this aspect, do you think that your Lord is pleased with you and me when we miss those opportunities? I know he's not. Something I've got to work on. Another thing. For us to be successful, we have to persevere. Are you going to get rejected when you try to teach people truth? Oh, yes. Yes, it will happen. What do you think causes that to make us... I'm trying to word this. Why does fear of rejection bother us so badly? I think it does. I think it's one of the biggest hindrances to Christians teaching the gospel. Why do you think it's such a big hindrance, John?
Sometimes it'll make you self-analyze where you're weak at. You might not know the Lord as good as you can.
Yeah.
It might make you doubt yourself some.
Yeah.
You might feel like you're on your own and the people around you are just, you know. I mean, we're supposed to be a little different than everyone else. But sometimes you don't like it staring back at you. You get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
I mean, if you talk about perseverance, when you look at that James 20, it's saying to you're turning a sinner from error, but you're saving their soul from death.
Yeah.
You might not get that on your first time.
Yeah.
It's going to take work.
It is. It is. It's going to take a commitment. And I think sometimes... maybe we're not ready and willing to make the commitment. John's point is a good one too. Sometimes when you're studying with others, it may expose a flaw in you, right? And what if they start asking questions you don't know the answer to? That might be embarrassing. What else can really make it to where rejection will keep us from saying what we need to say?
And a little while more.
Okay.
Not really.
Good. Matt?
As humans, we just like to be told no. And especially, we live in a yes society where it seems like we get our way more times than not. And when you're, I think pride plays into it some.
Yeah.
And man, when you get told no, it cuts your legs out from under you and damages your pride. And, pride can be a bad thing.
I think pride is a huge part. And I think that's one of the reasons we don't want to be told no, first of all. I think that hurts our pride. If
you get persecuted against too.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
They might be hostile toward you. They might even go as far as, you know, get away from me.
It is, and it can even be something where, I mean, they may tell other people all kinds of things about you. Hey, he's a crazy religious zealot, man. Oh, he's doing this stuff. I think all of those, pride ties in with that and can make it very, very difficult for us. We don't like to be, and to go back to John's point, what if I know I need to study with somebody, but what if they ask a question I can't answer, and so it makes me look bad? Well, what's causing me to worry about that?
Yourself.
Probably pride, right? And so a lot of it comes back down to that. I really think fear and pride run together. That causes a lot of problems. Look at Acts 14, verse 19. Anytime that I feel like just quitting, you know, you try to study with somebody, you think that they're... Here's a soft heart, you think, based on what you can see, and you say, here's a real opportunity to study with somebody, and they just... completely shut it down. Just the whole, no, I don't want to study with you. And that's just, they don't beat around the bush. They're like, no, I'm not interested. And you just reject it and thinking, oh, man, what? Where do we go from here? Look at any time that happens and you feel that feeling coming on. Go to Acts 14, verse 19. The Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there. Now they're outside of Lystra. And we'll talk about this more, Lord willing, probably tonight and Wednesday night. Having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. Okay, so basically, when Paul and Barnabas get to Lystra, there's a very good response on the part of the people there, primarily Gentiles. But the Jews from Antioch and Iconium that Paul and Barnabas made mad earlier travel 100 miles to where they are to stir up the people against them. And it works. They stir them up against Paul and Barnabas. What ends up happening?
Try to kill him.
They stone Paul to the point that they think he's dead. So, I mean, he is messed up badly. Read verse 20. However, when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up and went into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. And I'm not going to wear out our Bible class here because we're going to have time to talk about this, but we always talk about how Paul got up and he went to Derbe. That's not what he did first. Paul got up and went where? The city where they had stoned him and dragged him out. He goes right back in there. Now, what if this was a man who was easily frustrated and just gave up easily? And then he does go on to Derbe. And they have much success if you keep on reading down there. Verse 21, they made many disciples while they're down there. What if he had quit? What if he had said, you know, I can't deal with this rejection. These people throwing rocks at me. What if he quit then?
Yeah,
somebody else would have had to have taught him, right? If they're going to hear truth. He would have missed all these opportunities. But not this guy. He gets up and he goes and he teaches. I need to see that because I think sometimes, and Matt mentioned it, we talk about persecution. Our idea of persecution is a lot different, I think, than what Paul's was. You know, we get some harsh looks and we're like, oh, this is too much. It's just, whoo. Do you know what they said about the church on Facebook? I just don't think I can't do this anymore. Come on, man. They're throwing rocks. And they're not throwing them at Paul, like in his general direction to run him off. They're throwing at his face. And they apparently landed some. So this is entirely different. And yet, these men had conviction enough in the Lord to do what they needed to do. Matthew 10:14. Do you remember what the disciples were to do when they taught the gospel and it was rejected? Shake the dust off their feet. And then do what? Move on and find somebody else to teach. And we see that actually in the book of Acts as well. We're going to see Paul doing that. So keep at it. It's too important of a job to quit. You know, what about talking about jobs? What if you have a job as a telemarketer and the first person you call rejects you and you say, I can't deal with this. I quit. How's the job going to work out for you? Right? It is our job as Christians to teach the gospel. What if the first time somebody says, I want that, we quit? Keep going. Keep chopping. Keep trudging. And there are souls out there who want to hear truth. I'm convinced that there are. The reason I say that is because this world is still standing. This world is still standing. There are souls out there that will respond to the gospel. We need to take it to them. We need to be busy about it. Go ahead, John.
You got to play the numbers. And when you're sowing seeds, not every single one of them is going to take.
Yeah.
That's why you throw a bunch of them.
Yeah.
You might talk to 10 people and one of them is saved. That one person is doubling what you're doing.
Yeah.
They might go out and get that same fire. And, you know.
How many might they teach?
That's why there was disciples and not just one disciple.
Yeah, right. And here's another thing to consider. Even if for ourselves. And I think about the watchman as Ezekiel talks about it. Even if you teach somebody and they reject it, in the judgment, what can they say against you? They can't say a word. They can't look at me and say, you should have told me. And you know that song that we sing, You Never Mentioned Him to Me, which is the most gut-wrenching song I have ever heard a congregation sing, because it is such an accusation. And it's so true. They can't say it to you if you try. So, at least, you remember what Ezekiel tells the watchman. If the watchman, if he sounds the horn and the people are overcome, well, whose fault is it? It's the people's. And the watchman did what he was supposed to do. We need to sound the call. Okay, let's look at, we talked about this earlier. Just put a couple verses with it. If we're going to be successful, absolutely going to have to love the souls of others. I remember we were in a I guess it's a child rearing class. This was years ago. We were still at Oak Grove. Of course, we didn't have any kids, but they said people who are thinking they will be parents one day come to this class as well. And they were just talking about different things you want to instill in your kids. And I remember thinking even then, I want my kids to look at other people and see souls. Not see black people or white people or Asian people. See souls in need of a Savior. Because then there will be no... It's easy to get past the physical when you're looking at the spiritual, right? You won't let those physical things get in the way of that. And I wanted that to be something that my kids did. Well, it needs to be something I do, too. Think about the fact that here's a soul that needs a Savior. Turn to 1 John 4. And I understand, really, in this context, you've got John writing to brethren. So I understand the bond of love spoken about here is especially between brethren, but I think we can apply it toward others as well. 1 John 4, verse 9, "In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God sent His only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another." And when I think about what He did for me, I should love the souls of others enough to be willing to tell them. And if they reject it, then they reject it, and you go tell somebody else. And I do think, as was mentioned earlier, pride is a big problem that will get in the way of that. Okay, let's look at one more. In order to be successful, our prayer lives must be strong. We will never be any good at this. And I feel like I can say that with all confidence. If we are not good at praying, we will never be good at teaching people the gospel. We won't, because our relationship with our God won't be very good. It's kind of hard to teach others about what their relationship with God should be if yours isn't very good. So prayer life must be strong. Mark 1, verse 35, if someone will read that for us, just gives us an example of what Jesus' prayer habit was like.
In the early morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went away to a secluded place and praying there.
You ever give much thought to this? Jesus is a member of the Godhead, right? He was still deity when He walked the earth. He was in the flesh of a man. Was He still deity? Yeah, He was. Does God know how Jesus feels about Him? Yeah. Does God know what their relationship is like? Yeah. And what is Jesus still doing early in the morning before everybody else is up and about? He is talking to His Father because He understands the importance of that relationship. Certainly this is an example for us too. I don't think for an instant this is to be lost on us. He's doing it to show us a good example. But will we take it? My line of communication with my Heavenly Father should be constant. You know, pray without ceasing. We read that verse, and as Paul writes to the Thessalonians, I speak to Him through prayer. How does He speak to me? Through His Word. Both of those need to be taken care of so I can get the conversation. And it is interesting. Does God know what I'm going to say to Him before I even open my mouth? Yeah. Does He still want me to say it? Yeah. He wants that relationship. And when you see God like that, He desperately wants our relationship with Him to be what it was supposed to be. He wants it badly. That's the kind of love that He has for His children. Let's go to Luke 6. 12, and then we'll finish with that one. Luke 6, verse 12. "Now it came to pass in those days that He went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God." And if you look a few verses down, what's He praying about here? The apostles, right? He is praying about those men who will be His apostles. So we're to pray on a constant basis, certainly when things are very, very big in our lives. I'm afraid, and I feel like I'm the world's worst, when things are heavy, we try to handle them ourselves first. and then go to God. Jesus here, the choosing of the apostles is coming. He goes. He spends all night in prayer to his Father. He understood how important that relationship is. I need to do it as well. Okay. Any thoughts so far on this? Okay, we'll finish that up. Just a couple more points on it. And next week, Lord willing, we're going to talk about edification, the building up of one another spiritually. Thank you, guys.